I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When did you find out?
You never told me before.
I've not told you, no. Oh. It must be when you had a drink and you weren't listening to me then.
No, no, Sandra, you've never told me.
No, not, all right.
But you are getting forgetful.
Yeah, but I told you about bleeding 5 years ago. I wasn't forgetful then and you weren't forgetful then. Was we 5 years ago? No,
I don't know.
Hello and welcome. This is episode 12 of the Paul Ryder Tapes. I'm Angela Smith, Paul's ex-wife, and in the months leading up to his death, we sat down and he told his incredible, complete life story, the bare naked truth with an unparalleled level of honesty. 12 days after we finished recording, he passed away suddenly. Coming up in this episode.
There were always arguments, but at that point, in 99, there were just always horrible, horrible arguments, horrible things being said while we were on stage. It wasn't a nice place to be in our band, I didn't think, 99, really.
Walking out of the room, and this kid was walking towards me and went, "You're the reason I've got a heroin habit."
Paul's band ended up being Sean's band, and he got Bev as well. So the focus was very much on Sean and Bev.
Both took the tops off, fisticuffs, I was reffing, and then they put them back on and went back to rehearse again.
I would have killed him because of the way he was treating me, especially on stage down the microphone. I wanted to kill him because of the shit he was saying.
We left the last episode where the Mondays had reformed in 1999 for a comeback tour.
I remember the rehearsals were very tense. I remember there was often flare-ups between you and Sean in the rehearsal room. Yeah. We were filming at the time.
Oh.
And I remember Rowetta chasing me out of the room with a camera because you and Sean were fighting and she didn't want me to get that on camera.
Right.
Do you remember that?
You were really protective of them. You were like, "You've got to get out now. You can't film this."
I'm still like that now. I still would be now. I can't bear it. It's even worse now. Imagine with everyone camera phones. I hate it.
Yeah, so when I first met you, you were drinking a lot, and I didn't know anything about addiction, and I didn't know that heroin addicts who'd stopped taking heroin should also steer clear of alcohol.
No, neither did I. Well, yeah, I did, actually. I knew that, but yeah. wasn't following the programme.
And then my friend Nigel, who still is, thank the Lord, a recovering addict, he must have...
Love Nigel.
Yeah, he must have 30 years sober
at
this point.
Oh, God, yeah, must be.
But he was like my mentor for you. He used to take me to meetings for family members of addicts.
I didn't know
that. So I learned, yeah, you did at the time. I learned very quickly that this wasn't a good thing that you were drinking so much and it wasn't like party time.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to Dublin. You were doing a gig in Dublin and I was with you.
Right.
And you told me that your friends Andy and Dave, Disco Dave and Andy Hardy, wanted to talk to me.
Oh.
Paul's friend Dave Brattell and his wife Maureen remember that day really well.
It was a time when me and Paul had a what's it called when you can confront people?
Intervention?
Yeah. Me and Andrew were getting increasingly concerned about Paul.
And Paul's friend Andy recalls his troubling mental state.
It was fragile then. It was still fragile, but it was emerging out of that kind of few years, those few difficult years then. He's beginning to, again, but it can all unravel very, very quickly unless you haven't got support there.
It was quite clear that, you know, he was losing it. You know, he was in the middle of, you know, somewhere not very good. Mm. And he was trying to get away with things with both of them and everything. So we said, look, it's going to be an awful thing to do, but let's go down and confront him face to face and tell him exactly that we know exactly what's going on and make him face up to things. We've never done this before, you know what I mean? We're not Jerry Springer or anything. And so we went down. We didn't actually, it was at Linda's, and we went down on, I think it was a Sunday afternoon or something, and Linda, and we said, well, we've come to see Paul. Linda had to wrench him out of bed, and he came down, and we sat him down in the back kitchen, and just told him, you know, we are close mates, you know, you're going nowhere, you're not kidding anyone, you've got to do something, you know, why, and just put it all out, and he was in tears, you know what I mean? It really, mm-hmm. You know, it hit him hard. And me and Andy were devastated afterwards. You know what I mean? You know, we went away, not even convinced it would do any good, but at least we knew that we'd...
But you needed to say that it didn't do, that was the thing.
We tried.
Yeah. You said, if you don't tell Angela, I will. That's what I think happened.
Yeah. Yeah,
so he told me when we were in Dublin, because he was frightened that you would tell me.
Because we just said, you know...
Well, it's just so unfair, isn't it? You can't start a relationship with somebody and you need to know that they know.
And I said, what do they want to talk to me about? And you said, they're going to tell you that I've started using again.
Oh, my God. Did this really happen?
Absolutely devastated.
Oh. Because I didn't know.
I kind of sensed that you were a bit different.
Uh-huh.
But I couldn't quite work out what was going on because, like now, I'd know a mile off. But
yeah.
I didn't really put two and two together, but you definitely changed. There was a change in you. Mm. And it was when we were in Dublin, you confessed to me that was going on, and that gave me,
mm-hmm.
as a codependent person, my mission to fix you.
Oh.
Which lasted for about 17 years
of
my life, trying to...
I couldn't have had a habit if it was in Dublin, because I wouldn't have known where to score.
You didn't have a habit, but you were dabbling.
Yeah.
But that's enough, isn't it? You
of
know
course,
it's a slippery slope.
And I knew it would end up the way it ended up.
And the way it ended up was you going into the Priory.
Yes, yes. Was that after a stint in, what's the one in Lytham St Anne's?
No, that was afterwards.
That was afterwards?
The first one that I witnessed you going into was the Priory in Altrincham.
Right.
You did actually manage to get clean, and you came out determined to do those summer festival shows clean and sober.
Yes, yes.
So you came out of the Priory, and you... The reason that I stayed with you was because you always expressed a desire to be clean and stay clean. You never went, fuck it, I'm just going to use.
No.
So I always believed that you wanted to be clean.
Yeah.
And that's what kept me in it, I think, because I wanted to support that.
Yeah.
So a newly clean Paul then had a string of festival gigs that summer that former percussionist Lee Mullen remembers better than Paul, particularly a gig they did in Japan.
I remember as soon as we got off the plane, there was loads and loads of schoolgirls looked like schoolgirls with really short skirts on and white socks. And I remember Rowetta kicking off saying, do not let any of them on our coach. I remember that. I remember going, do not let any of them on our coach. And she was quite right.
But the whole thing, the Japanese thing, the culture thing is totally different to anywhere else. I've been lucky enough to go back to Japan a couple of times with other artists and since then. And it freaks me out every time I go there, to be honest. I mean, we didn't really spend that much time there. I remember us, we flew in from somewhere. We stayed on the tour bus at the airport and then flew out to Japan the next day. So we flew in from, I think we might have flown in from doing Galway Festival or somewhere. We flew in from doing a festival and then we stayed at the airport pub, which was the airport pub in on the tour bus in the car park, and then flew out the day after to Japan because it was a really early flight. It was crazy. I remember doing Slane Castle and I realised then that how much of good friendship Robbie Williams had with Paul. When Robbie Williams was massive and he would just brought out Let Me Entertain You and all those. And I think he just had the Angels and all those. And anyway, he was like really, he was like, that was like 300,000 people, 250,000 people at Slane Castle.
And Paul did really well. He managed to pull them all off newly clean and sober, despite the tension between him and Sean escalating. One person who witnessed the tension up close was their tour manager's assistant and personal manager, Anthony Murray, also known as Muzza.
We were really close to the pair of them because I was in the middle of them all the time. He was just cool as fuck, Paul. Never got annoyed. Might have been annoyed, but he never shown it. Never let Sean know that it was ever affecting him. I just don't understand it. And I don't understand why. And Paul never did anything bad. Sean's not. He fights with his mouth and it's bullshit.
Paul and Sean's mum, Linda, tells Gaz Whelan's mum, Sandra, that Sean had displayed a similar personality from the day he was born.
From the minute Sean was born, we knew he was here. We knew he was here. He never slept. He never stopped crying. And he never was never still. And when I come to... And he was being thoroughly ruined. They told me I shouldn't have any more children for at least 4 years. When Sean, now I know why, when Sean was born, I came out in this rash all over and they said it was shock. Shock.
Paul would always wanted his dad to be right up on a pedestal. Sean didn't.
Right.
Sean kept Eric always down. Paul always pumped him up. Paul had a great relationship then. Whatever going on with Sean and his dad was early doors, always fighting. But Paul, the only fights I've seen them two fight was over Derek. When Sean said something about Derek and Paul would have none of it. Never fucking throw his guitar, bottle at him. That's the only time he'd get violent straight away. And Sean would do it on a regular basis.
And they told me not to think of having any more children.
Really?
I was so traumatised for at least 4 years.
Derek was the main boy looking after them. He had their backs more than anything. And Sean knew that, but he didn't want to give him the glory of it.
Was he a naughty baby?
No. I mean, I had feeding... He was 11 pounds, don't forget, 11 and a half pounds. So none of his clothes fit him when he was born. We had to cut a brand new baby in 90s with ragged sleeves where Derek could cut.
Muzza had been working with the band since the very early days and it took him a while to become a fan of the music after a friend suggested that they'd go and see them play.
We went to watch them in Midleton and at the Trade Centre and I walked in and it was the worst thing I'd ever seen in my life. And I was used to Pink Floyd and Doors and productions and I know nothing, Talking Heads. And this is on stage. Bezzy's falling over. Sean's falling over. The fucking noise. I'm like, oh, my God, what the fuck is this?
I got rheumatic fever. So I had to go back to my mum's for 3 months. So he was being picked up, nursed all the time and played with and had all the attention. And I said to Derek, do you know what? This is getting ridiculous. The sooner we have another child, the better.
But they were dead nice kids. We met Sean and said, we'll come down the boardwalk. And that's when I met Paul. It was dead chilled out, dead laid back.
I literally used to pray to God, please let this baby sleep. And I think God must have listened to my prayers too much. Because Paul was just the opposite. He always slept.
knew Paul was the one that had something about him. And they did, so I'm not disrespecting them, but you know who's there. When Paul said, Sean said, this is my brother, Paul. I was thinking, wow, two brothers in the band.
And the band soon asked Muzza to work for them. But in those early days, he didn't join them for the love of their music.
I wasn't there for the band because it was completely shit to me. And as I've got headphones on, listen, I've got talking heads and they think I'm dancing to them. But I'd have Tom Jones on and Glenn Campbell. I come from that type of thing with mum and dad, so I love that music. All the times he comes with a Walkman with fucking Glenn Campbell on, and I said, yeah. He goes, what do you think? I go, it's mint, the tune's great. And he goes, you fucking got Glenn Campbell, little green apples on. And Paul used to just laugh. After touring for 10 years, taking loads of pills, I loved him in the end. Pissed and having loads of ease. Yeah, anyone would. I did like him. Just for the benefit of the tape, I did like him.
Eventually. So, I was pregnant with Sonny by this point, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I was definitely in it. And I remember you saying to me, when I was pregnant, you said to me, I've got you now.
Oh, dear.
I've got you now.
That's sick.
It was, wasn't it? It was really sick. You said, yeah. I've got you now.
Oh, wow.
Because you did. Like, 18 years, we're going to have a connection through a child, whether we're together or not. You got me, you got that.
Got a connection.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was during that time that he met Jason Godwin at a self-help meeting, and Jason would go on to become one of Paul's closest friends.
He came to a meeting in Hartford, where I used to go as well. And I always remember it because Tom and Paul were sitting on the other side of the room. For the whole of this meeting, Paul was staring at me, and I was thinking, what's wrong with me? What is it? And after the meeting, you know, we went and had a coffee, me, Tom and Paul, and he said to me, he said, oh, I like your trainers. He goes, I was clocking them in the meeting, your trainers. I was like, it's a funny thing, I was like into your trainers as well. And he took my number, and like at the time, you know, I wasn't probably like most people in those meetings, you know, Paul as well, you know, I was really, really struggling in my life. And he called me the next day and I was like, no way, he's calling me. What does he want? And I answered and we're chatting away and he's like, oh, it was good to see you last night and that. And he said, do you want to swap them trainers you got on for my trainers?
Really? I didn't know.
And that's how it started. And we went on for years after that, just swapping clothes, because we were around about the same sort of height and size and same foot size as well. So, yeah, we have that's kind of the first memories I have of meeting Paul. The next thing I kind of remember is coming down to St. Paul's Road in Islington, where I remember knocking on the door, Tom knocking on the door, because we was going to go out with Paul to a meeting.
Yeah.
And Paul opened the door and you just walked out of the toilet. I'd never met you before. And you just literally found out that you was pregnant with Sonny.
Yeah.
So we turned up at the most inappropriate of moments because it was clearly, you know, a special moment for you two. We ended up going to a meeting and stuff, but that's the first time I remember meeting you both. We were supposed to go to a meeting and he said, oh, I'm going to call round and see my mate, see Rob. Yeah. And I just thought it was his mate, Rob. So we went up to Notting Hill, me and Tom and Paul, and he knocks on the door and it was Robbie Williams he was going to see, right? And I found myself in Robbie Williams' house with Paul and Tom. And before I knew it, he was inviting us to Wembley to see him play at Wembley with Paul. I think it was what I identified in Paul was that kind of social awkwardness, that kind of vulnerability, just feeling very fragile and very delicate, and an imposter syndrome almost, you know, low self-esteem, all that kind of stuff. We shared it, you know, and as I got to know him and that, I realized he was just as fragile as I was. And I think that's what drew us together. You know, we were delicate souls.
So the year the millennium, mm-hmm. New Year's Eve, 1999. You were clean at that point.
Oh, right.
You'd started going back to meetings. I think you'd done a second stint in the Priory.
Yeah, I think.
And I remember we celebrated the millennium in Manchester at an NA party.
Oh, we did, yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
With Rob F., who went out of his way, another one who went out of his way to try and help me, took you to meetings galore.
Love Rob F. Big shout out to Rob F.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah, my goodness, he did. He went out of his way. He was doing up our house.
Mm-hmm.
So I got pregnant with Sonny, bought a house in Manchester, sold my house in London.
Mm-hmm.
And we rented a flat in the city centre while the house was being done up. And I remember one day you were clean, one day you went to buy a jukebox.
Yeah, I remember that.
Came back. And you'd used again.
Oh, you spotted straight away, didn't you? By them days.
Yeah, it's bad.
There was no getting away with it.
No.
But then again, it shows how strong the addiction is. Because I knew that you would know straight away. But it didn't matter. It just didn't matter.
So you must have been really scared to come home because you'd know that there would be a fight.
Oh, yeah. What
did that feel like?
Awful. Still feels awful right now. It's painful.
Yeah, it's important to own it, though, isn't it?
Yeah, you got to own it.
And I often wonder what might... Because a lot of people said to me that you would never stop using while you were still with me because I was enabling you just by providing you with a home and with comfort, with home comfort and somewhere to be.
Well, we proved that wrong. Because we had 8 years of not using before we split up.
Yeah, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll talk about that later because I've got opinions about that too.
Okay. Let's get back to the music.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
So then we had Sonny and you made a very big decision just after we'd had Sonny. Because you'd again managed to get clean. And you said that if you carried on being in the band with Sean, because relations between the two of you were fractious.
Oh, very.
I remember the then manager Neil Mather was responsible for being with Sean as he came off stage, and I was responsible for being with you when you got off stage.
To keep
so
us
you
apart.
Didn't fight.
The only reason we was going to fight is because he was goading me on stage.
Monday singer Rowetta has unpleasant memories of that time too.
There were always arguments back at that point. In 99, there were just always horrible arguments, horrible things being said while we were on stage. It wasn't a nice place to be in our band, I didn't think, 99 really. I mean, I left in 2000. We all left because of arguments with Sean. I think even Bez left eventually for a while. But it was just, I just remember it not being a nice place.
What was he doing? What was he saying?
Oh, our kid's a wanker, fucking shit like that.
Yeah.
You know, just bad mouthing me all the way through concerts. Yeah. That was one of the reasons I left the band. Yeah. It was like, if I carry on, I'm going to kill him or I'm going to go back on heroin. And that's why I left.
The band's tour assistant, Anthony Murray, witnessed the trouble between the brothers firsthand.
I shared a room with Sean all the way through all the tours. I've got great memories. I've got a photographic memory, Angela. I can remember things word for word. and there's some heavy shit went on down. Probably pop star bullshit.
Yeah.
Paul didn't have pop star bullshit. He was a pop star better than anyone, but he didn't have the bullshit with it.
It didn't help that the band would usually fly economy to the shows, but Sean would travel first class and insist that Muzza travel first class with him, which made Muzza feel really bad for the rest of the band.
Sean's always insisted I went first class. They'd be in economy, but he goes, ah, fuck the band, fuck them. Paul would say, don't worry about it, it's not you. But Paul was always reassuring you, saying, don't worry about it, we know it ain't you. I'm like, ah, fucking hell, what do I do? He's going, it's him, he's insisting that he loved that shit. Then you got the brother shit, so he's going to go down. One's really cool, and you know, Ange, when you're arguing with someone, they don't argue back, it does your fucking head in. You want to, if you've got a better hanging, and they're cool, you can't beat them with your tongue because they're that cool. That's so, it's so upsetting, so annoying, so I don't know how to explain it.
The tension between the brothers had been brewing for years, as Paul and Sean's mum Linda and Gaz Whelan's mum Sandra explain.
They're lovely, weren't they? And then all hell broke out, didn't it, when they were older?
It was after the band started, really.
Were they all right at school, yeah?
Yeah. Oh, well, they went out together when they left school. They were always together. They were all, I always said it was when girls got involved.
Well, could be, yeah. Mm.
You know, they always criticised each other's girlfriend.
Monday's guitarist Mark Day found himself in the middle of fights sometimes.
Well, they're just brothers, weren't they? They were just, you know, they would argue and bicker over some minor things. I mean, I had to referee quite a few times. It was quite funny one time when there was some argument, I don't know what it was about, but it ended up in the ginnel at the back there. They both took the tops off, fisticuffs, I was reffing, and then they put them back on, went back to rehearse again. You didn't know what you were going to get, what day, if they was talking or if there was something going on. It just got worse. I think it was either petty over money or something or other. You talk about the Gallagher brothers, nothing on Sean and Paul. I'd just become immune to it.
They were such good close pals for one another.
Oh, there you go. Somebody's throwing a tambourine at somebody.
It's a shame, that, really. Yeah.
Oh, there you go. They're fighting on stage again.
But then my mother used to say, right, I'm not having them both together again.
Oh, there you go. The CS gas has gone off.
He wants what he's got, and he wants what he's got.
If we get kicked out of the hotel, it just got used to it.
And then the arguing starts.
Just brothers, innit?
Monday's singer Oweta remembers one particular fight very vividly.
The arguments got worse later on, especially between the brothers. I remember a fight in Nathan's office with Sean and Paul. I think they'd gone outside, saying outside. And I remember Sean had said, you've got blood on my shirt. When they came back in, there was blood all over Sean's shirt. And instead of saying, you beat me up or you punched me, you've got blood all over my shirt. I do remember that. But yeah, they'd gone outside to have a proper fist fight, but I didn't obviously see it. I just remember Sean saying about the blood.
And Monday's vibes meister, Bez, lived to regret getting between them one day when fisticuffs were occurring.
It wasn't so bad at first, but there was always a little power battle going on between them, which was like, you know what I mean? And the biggest mistake I ever made was when I've tried breaking up, they were fighting one day, full on fight. I thought, fucking hell, I'm going to have to break him up. And I went in and Paul bit me thumb that hard. He nearly bit it off. And I thought, ah. I said, oh, she fucking biting me fucking thumb, you know what I mean? But, yeah, they used to have fights all the time. And it's because they were both so competitive with each other, you know what I mean? And you know, there's always a chance to out-cool each other. It was the coolest.
Former Monday's keyboardist Paul Davis has his own take on the situation.
There were two separate lads, two brothers, two different people. And Paul was always in charge, you know, Paul would make the decision. And Sean thinks he's made the decision. It was just like a power, you know, you would sit with the band, the bass player, the guitarist, the keyboard player, the drummer, would do the music. And Sean would do his side. It was just like, that's how it went.
And I asked one of Paul's best friends, Gaz Whelan, the Monday's drummer, for his take.
Talk to me about the rivalry between the brothers.
They kind of both would never admit there was one.
I didn't really see any competition until they were much older. I didn't notice it until much older. I just thought, brothers. You know, I had a younger brother. I didn't talk to him, you know, so. And I was younger, so they all kind of looked at me as just a little bit of a kid, maybe. So they would get into arguments and literally fist fights. And Mark, because he's big, would jump in the middle of them. And I had two fights with Sean, never had any fights with Paul. But they had a kind of... I don't feel early on, there didn't seem to be a rivalry. Paul was in charge of the band early on. And I think Sean was quite happy with that. You know, Paul was one that was really serious about it all. I think Sean... I wouldn't say it wasn't serious, but it wasn't as, was a bit more carefree about it. The relationship between us all deteriorated. And I think early on, Mark always kept himself on the outside away from it all, wisely. But me, PD, Paul and Sean were very close. And then Bez when he came in. Bez was always a free bird doing his own thing. I didn't have an older brother, I had an older sister, so Paul was like an older brother to me. And I know that's a real cliche, but he really was. You know, like I said, we were very close and got on. And then we fell out over silly things, but he was like a little brother to me. So it was a band thing, right? I didn't see it as them two. In fact, I didn't see him as brothers in the band. They was always trying to outdo each other.
Right.
They always trying to outdress each other and out aftershave each other early on. I remember that. You could go in an hotel and you know which hotel room each of them was in. Because you could smell it down the lobby. I remember getting in a lift once in New York and I could smell the aftershave. I got in the one lift going up and it was Lagerfeld, so that was Sean's. And then coming down it was Hugo Boss and it was Paul's. No, it might not have been Hugo Boss. I thought that when I said it was probably something more expensive. But I've just bought Poise to wear Lagerfeld's. Oh, yeah, what was the one Poise to wear?
He wore Lagerfeld and he wore Aqua de Parma. That was one of his...
That's the one, the Mediterranean man one, yeah. That's the one, yeah.
Gio Trumper that you have to go to Bond Street for. He used to like that one as well.
Their former manager, Phil Sachs, has his own observations.
I think a little bit like the Brian Jones and Mick Jagger type situation with the Stones. You know, Brian Jones's band ended up being Mick Jagger's band. And I think to some degree that's true. You know, Paul's band ended up being Sean's band. And he got Bez as well. So the focus was very much on Sean and Bez. And of course, I think there was always an undercurrent with Paul that he wanted some recognition for himself.
I reminded Gaz Whelan, the Mondays drummer, about the time just before Paul left in 1999 when I had a job to do at those live shows.
I remember at the gigs, I'd have to get Paul and Neil Mather would have to get Sean and take them off into different places so that they didn't kick off after the shows. Then just after I had Sonny, he decided he would leave the band because he was worried about getting back. He said, if I stay in the band, I'll go back to heroin because Sean is winding me up too much.
I remember that, and I remember it was just before the Australia tour, going to Australia. I remember that, yeah.
So he pulled out and Sean was fuming. You were very understanding about why he pulled out.
Rowetta too understood and supported Paul's decision to leave.
I just remember it not being a nice place. So it probably during rehearsals, it was really, it was just bad. It was... Yeah, it's the comments, as I say, you don't hear them. I've heard him since on videos where he says things under his breath and you don't realise until it's about you. And then when he started saying things to me, I realised what he does. And he says the same thing every night at the same time and it gets to you. And that's what he was doing with Horse, because Horse hasn't got a microphone.
He didn't like it because I left.
So you'd been offered a tour supporting Oasis.
Yeah.
And it was a big deal, that tour, because it was big venues. I think it involved going to Australia as well.
Australia I missed out on, and the Oasis gigs I missed out on, but I would have killed him because of the way he was treating me, especially on stage down the microphone. But I wanted to kill him because of the shit he was saying.
Yeah.
You know? And when I finally found the strength to walk away...
How did it feel walking away?
Awful. It was like a death.
Yeah.
Like a death. It's like from when we first split up, it was like a death. Yeah. Like a death in the family. You know, that's all I'd known for many years. And I'd worked hard to get the band where it was. Mm-hmm. We'd all worked hard.
Do you remember who you told first?
It would have been Gaz.
And what did Gaz say?
it's probably a good idea.
Yeah.
Mm.
Gary really cared about your sobriety, didn't he?
Mm.
The percussionist from that time, Lee Mullen, was really upset to learn that Paul had been pushed so far that he didn't feel he could continue in the band.
That was the first thing. I looked over and it wasn't his rig there, and then I realised that he wasn't doing the band. And all I heard that him and Sean had had a fallout. That's all I knew.
And what did Sean say?
Nothing to me personally. We didn't speak for years after that. But via other people, I heard he was calling me an arsehole and a wanker for leaving.
I remember him saying, why doesn't he just take a bit of heroin if that's how bad he feels?
Yeah. Obviously doesn't know anything about addiction. Being a using addict, he'd never really give it a chance.
So Paul missed out on some really great shows supporting Oasis, who Paul had become pretty friendly with over the years.
When we did the tour with Oasis, basically all Liam, because I've known Liam and Noel since I was 14 anyway, but they'd all come into the Happy Mondays dressing room. They'd come in, well, Noel wouldn't, but Liam would and stuff. And all of a sudden, they would accuse him of getting drunk with us before they went on stage. So when we did the later gigs, like at Murrayfield and a few of the other gigs, the production would ban any of Liam coming anywhere near our dressing room.
Paul and Liam and Paul and Noel actually were pretty good friends.
Yeah.
They obviously had a history together. And I think I remember a wedding once, Paul talking to Liam about fighting with brothers and they were comparing notes about their brotherly feud.
To be really honest with you, I could see how they would get on because I've known Liam for a long time and obviously I knew Paul very well, so I could see why they would get on.
So then you didn't have a job. No. You left your band, you got a new young baby and two other children who were like 9 and 12 or 10 and 13.
Yeah.
You lived in a beautiful house in a beautiful part of Manchester,
mm-hmm.
backing onto a canal.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't enough, was it?
Still wasn't enough.
No, and leaving the band didn't stop you from relapsing either, did it?
No, it stopped me from killing him, but not from relapsing.
Right. And that, the next 9 years?
Mm-hmm. On and off.
Just
hell.
It was one rehab after another, mm-hmm. after another, after another.
Yeah.
In and out of recovery, mm-hmm. going to meetings, professing wanting to stay clean.
Mm-hmm. I always wanted to be clean, but I just couldn't. I didn't know how to do it.
What was it like going to meetings in Manchester for you?
Probably a bit difficult because people knew who I was and where, you know, where I'd come from. And so I remember going to an NA convention in Glasgow and walking out of a room and this kid was walking towards me and went, you're the reason I've got a heroin habit.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. And it was like, oh, really? Fucking hell, put in your step one, dude.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, so that wasn't nice.
No.
No.
So one of the rehabs you went to was a place called Pier Point in St Anne's.
Oh, my God.
Tell me about that.
I know a lot of people that went through that place and they're still in recovery, like, 30 years later. You know, a lot of good people. But for me, it was a bad experience. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm rattling my tits off on this really bad detox. And there was a white South African nurse that came up close to me and said, "You're in the music business, aren't you?" That's my white South African accent. And so I said, "Yeah." And he went, "All music is the devil's music." Oh, for fuck's sake, here we go. So I said, "What about Cliff Richard?" And he turned around and said, "He is the devil." So I waited till 8 o'clock in the morning when I knew you'd be awake and said, "Get me out of this place." This was a nurse that was saying this to me.
Yeah.
get me out of here. So it was out of that one and into another one the same day.
You went into the Priory later again. That day.
Yeah.
Which was a bit of a joke, really. I remember going in to visit you, and you'd obviously used.
Mm-hmm,
and the nurses. How could the nurses not spot that? Like, I walked in, I was like, you've used, what's happened? Who's given it to you? Like, No, I haven't. It's like, yes, you have.
I got it delivered.
Yeah.
Incredible, unbelievable.
Yeah. So you're in rehab to detox from heroin.
And I got it delivered.
And you got it delivered to yourself there.
Yeah, kind of sick, really.
Yeah.
That shows how strong addiction is.
Yeah. So you're paying thousands of pounds to be in a place.
Yeah.
But yet you sorted out your little supply. Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. And then after that, you came back and relapsed again.
Oh, my God.
And you ended up going to a place in Bristol.
In Bristol, yeah.
No, it wasn't Bristol. It was south of Bristol. I can't remember the name of it now.
It'll come to me. Yeah, but I only lasted a few days in there. I think I got a taxi to Bristol.
No, well, this was when you'd... Through the recovery circles, you'd become friends with Robbie Williams.
Mm-hmm.
And you went into a rehab somewhere in the southwest.
That's right, yeah.
And you decided that you weren't staying anymore. You,
no.
After paying thousands of pounds again.
Again.
I got a phone call from them saying, oh, he's left.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't hear from you for like 3 days. I had no idea where you were. So what? Tell me where you'd gone.
I got a taxi and I went to... what's the homeless place called?
You went to Bristol.
Not Samaritans. Salvation Army.
Yeah.
I got a taxi to the Salvation Army because I knew I'd be able to get drugs there. And I met this kid from Leeds who scored for me, and I went back to his house and spent 3 or 4 days there using. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, I'd phoned my friend Robbie, who jumped in a car with his driver and my mate Gary to come and rescue me from Bristol. And I said to this lad, don't be surprised when you open the door. And it was, Robbie was at the front door saying, where's Paul? I've come to give him a ride back to London.
So Robbie Williams came with his driver and picked you up out of his drug house.
Yeah, he rescued me. Thanks, Robbie. I never did say thank you for that, but thank you.
Yeah, and he took you back to London and then put you on a train.
Mm-hmm.
And called me and said, right, he's on a train.
Mm-hmm.
On his way to Blackpool. Oh, actually, from there you went into Pierpoint.
That's when I went into Pierpoint.
Yeah. And then from Pierpoint, you then went into the Priory.
Mm-hmm.
And then you came out of the Priory, and then the next 8 years was just you at home, depressed, really depressed.
Yeah.
Smoking cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
In your bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
Not really being able to look after your kids.
No, terrible state.
So one of the things that I did was we had a friend who had a house in France.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it'd be a really good idea if we bought a house in France, because it'd give you a project and that might help you stay clean. So we went to France. And again, you're sort of in and out of using at this point. You had some good periods and then you had some bad periods.
Yeah.
And we went to France.
Well, that you was right. It was a great project. I think we looked at 30 or 40, 45 properties.
Houses, and we bought the most expensive one.
Yeah, like you do.
The idea was to sell the big house and buy a cheaper one in Manchester, and with the difference, buy a small house in France.
Yeah.
But we ended up buying a really big house in France.
That was absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
Still is.
8 bedrooms, 8 bathrooms, little cottage in the grounds.
If anyone wants to rent it out for the summer, get in touch. We do rentals.
We actually still do rentals of the property. So check out the website and send us an email if you're interested in renting it. What's more, if you become a patron of the show by going to our Patreon account at patreon.com/thepaulrydertapes, you can get a full 20% discount on any quoted Airbnb price for any available dates there in the next 12 months. So shopping for a house in France was kind of fun, wasn't it?
That was great, yeah.
Do you remember all the houses we looked at?
Oh.
One with all the dead flies in.
Fly house. Never seen so many dead flies. It was incredible.
It was like someone had died in there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We didn't buy that one, though, did we?
We didn't buy Fly House.
No. Instead, talk about the house we ended up buying.
Well, there's this English guy showing us around. And he said, we told him we wanted to see this particular house, and he said, don't buy that, you'll hate it.
It's a terrible house.
It's a terrible house. So we went to look at it, and we went in this one bedroom that was in the attic, and there was a great big gold-coloured fibreglass bath there that fit about four people in it.
Yeah.
And the taps was figurines, and the water came out of a dragon's mouth. And we just said, we've got to have this one.
Yeah, and floor-to-ceiling mirror.
Floor-to-ceiling mirror and angled mirrors on the balcony so you could see what was going on the balcony. And we found out the guy that owned it used to have sex parties there. It was like, we'd definitely go have this house.
And it had floor-to-ceiling mirrors in that bedroom.
Oh,
as well.
Yeah.
And the bed was like a Chinese bed that was bolted to the floor.
Yeah,
four-poster thing. We did a lot of filming there at the time, and I found a clip of us being interviewed in 2004 about buying it. So this is like 18 years ago.
After shopping for a little tiny house with no work needed doing, we've come back with a gigantic pile that has got 5 acres of land and about 8 bedrooms and needs loads of work doing to it.
And I haven't got a clue about DIY.
What's DIY? Somebody in the 70s, presumably, made it really modern, but that was modern for the 70s. So it's great on the outside, but it's pretty bad on the inside. But almost so bad that it's good. So what we want to do is hang on to the best bits of the 70s stuff. But, I don't know, we're a bit confused.
Then put some original stuff back in, but also have some stuff from the new millennium in there, like a glass staircase.
Oh, no, I don't want a glass staircase.
No, no.
Oh, no.
What? A glass staircase.
Oh.
I'm excited. Because I've just been sitting on my ass for the past 2 or 3 years.
You don't sound very excited.
I'm excited.
There was a grate in the far room, one of the living rooms. We ripped it out, but it was a great cupboard that folded out with a mirror on there, and it was perfect for doing cocaine on.
Oh, I didn't
the
know that.
The cocaine mirror, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's what it was there for. And another reason we bought that strange house.
Yeah.
It was incredible. It was proper 1970s decor.
Yeah, there's a Jason King suite, we called it. Remember
Jason
that?
King, yeah, from Department S. Yeah, Jason King would have lived in that room.
Yeah.
Mega house.
So we asked our friend Jason, who just happened to be a builder, and you might recognise him from ITV's 60 Minute Makeover, to come over with us and help us evaluate the house. We thought we'd do it up and rent it out to holidaymakers to help cover the running costs.
When we went inside, it didn't look like it had any work done to it since about 1982. When the previous owner...
The 70s,
yeah. So it was, and I saw that it was total rewiring, replumbing, and I was thinking, I cannot let them buy this place, yeah. And I was doing everything in my power to put you off of it. The wiring hadn't been touched since the 70s, the plumbing hadn't been touched since the 70s, the decor hadn't been touched since probably the 60s. And it was a huge sprawling pad, wasn't it? You know, and I just thought you was taking on way, way more. And you was expecting me to kind of help you renovate this place. And I was thinking, I don't speak French. If I come over, how are we going to do all this? And yeah, it just seemed like way too much.
Yeah.
So we bought that one, the one he said, you don't go to that one, you won't like it. We liked it.
Yeah, it was great, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it was massive. It was huge. Enormous. We had no idea what we were taking on. We were so naive.
No idea. No, and 5 acres of land.
Yeah, with a river running through.
It was incredible.
So we had to put a swimming pool in, didn't we?
Yeah, if we was going to rent it out, the shenanigans of the swimming pool, 2 hours before the first guest was to arrive, we were still shovelling soil around the edge of the pool.
Ben Leach was helping us. Remember, the keyboard player from the Mondays lived up the road.
Yes, yes, Ben was helping us out a lot. Man. Yeah. He was great. He was an electrician, he was a builder. He could do anything, Ben.
Yeah.
And then it burnt down.
Yeah, we'll come to that later.
All half of it burnt down.
We'll come to that later. That's okay. A few years later. So we bought this house and I was thinking, this will help Paul stay clean. It'll be a project for him.
Mm-hmm. And it was a project,
yeah.
But it didn't help.
It didn't really make you stay
clean. Once again,
clean,
another example of how strong addiction is.
The last time that I saw Paul, what was beautiful about that is that he remembered that it was Emily's birthday, my daughter's birthday, and he got her a card and he put 50 quid in there. And when we met up with him, he gave her the card. I didn't know that was the last time I was going to see him because we was planning to meet him the weekend before he passed away at Alexandra Palace. We was going down to see him there, and that's when I was texting him because it all came through via social media that, you know, Paul had died. That's the way I found out. Tom sent me a message saying, "Have you heard about Paul?" And I knew when he'd sent me the message that Paul had died, strangely enough. Mm. And so I think I went on and had a look, and it was saying that Paul had passed away. He'd been texting like 2 or 3 days before that, you know, about meeting up and doing everything. So I'd started texting him saying, "Paul," you know, because I just didn't want to believe that at all.
Yeah.
And I had COVID at the time, and we was in the middle of a heat wave. So I was like, I was really ill. Yeah. And I did. It was just the most surreal. It was the most heartbreaking. It was awful. And then I think me and you spoke that evening. And when I finally spoke to you, that's when I kind of accepted that, you know, he'd passed away. And even now, you know, there's a part of me that thinks that, you know, he's still around, you know. The impact he had on my life, along with yourself, Ange, is something that, as you know, it changed everything. It was a game changer. Just, you know, just you two were so down to earth and so not rock and roll and so not kind of showbiz, but just decent, honest, you know, just lovely, lovely people to spend time with. I look back now and I know there was lots of heartache and kind of stress and trauma, but I can look back and honestly say that it was a fantastic time in my life, and you know, I miss him dearly every day. There's not a day goes by I don't think about him. I still can't listen to their music. I don't think I'd ever go to a Mondays gig again.
Coming up on the next episode.
I enjoyed it.
I just thought it was crap. The music part in it I like, but the rest I thought, it's a load of nonsense,
this. Your dad, who was the tour manager,
oh, yeah,
had to
yeah.
stand in for Pete.
He was pressing buttons and pretending to play the keyboards.
Yeah.
And then Pete walked on like halfway through the show.
Happy Mondays, I recognise that it was probably the first band since the Stranglers to me where the bass was monumental, you know what I mean? It's like you could tell this kid on bass knew how to write a good bass line and how to play it.
I looked up and saw like the roof was on fire, the ceiling. That's when I called you saying, "It's on fire, what do I do?"
You'd left the two boys in the house that was burning.
Yes.
He storms out through this door, yeah. Shuts the door behind him, and then like about 10 seconds later, he comes out and says, "It's a cupboard."
We're playing out with the acoustic version of the Big Arm track, Sun Rays. Watch out for the album dropping any day now. Thank you to our new patrons of the show. That's Nick G and his son Manny, as well as Stephen Merriman, who joins us from Spain.
There are only a limited number of founding member places left, so if you would like to join our club, get yourself signed up by going to patreon.com/thePaulRyderTapes. Visit the website at paulryder.tv for links to our socials and our shop where you can bag some fab merch. Thank you to the guests and thank you to you, that's you, yes, for being with us. We really appreciate all of the lovely messages that you keep sending, and we love it that we've created a really nice community amongst ourselves. The podcast will be back again next Sunday, same time, same place. And if you'd like to watch this podcast on video, it's available in a week's time. They release every Sunday at 8 p.m. UK time. And me and Paul's youngest son, Chico, are always in the chat live answering any questions you may have. So do join us. The only thing left to say is, as usual, big thanks to the man himself who opened his heart and soul for this series, the one and only Paul Anthony Ryder. I love the sun, a sunny day, sunrise, sunrise. I love the sun, a sunny day, sunrise. Sunrise, I love the sun, a sunny day. Sunrise, sunrise. Glistening Productions.
'Cause on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.